This evening is the second part of the exploration of equanimity. And again, just briefly, as though sitting under the Bodhi tree with the about to be Buddha. As he was protected that now famous night, sitting under the tree, protected within the great strength of his mindful presence, which was enlivened by a keen interest and a penetrating sense of investigation, exploration, accompanied by clear discernment. This about to be Buddha, supported by the tremendous energy of his determination and the flow of an effortless effort, imbued with an enlivening and refreshing joy, and balanced within the deep power and cool ease of an unwavering, undistracted mind. Siddhartha Gautama, sitting under the Bo tree that night with unshakable stability, with an evenness and balance of receptive presence, as though he were an immovable mountain, the mountain of equanimity. We looked at the first insight that is the basis of equanimity. This first insight being the understanding of karma. The second insight that equanimity is based on is the teaching and the understanding of anatta, no self. So, from this perspective, there's no one, no self, performing any deeds, nor do the results affect any self. The fact is, the truth is that it's the delusion of a separate solid self, a separate me, that creates suffering and disturbs equanimity. If we claim ownership, this is mine, this is me, this is who I am, the various vicissitudes of life that we've listed a few times will always throw us into the realm of suffering. So, an example. If this or that aspect of our personality, some particular quality of ours, is criticized or is blamed, one thinks, I am blamed, and equanimity is shaken. Maybe we receive approval or we receive praise for something that we've done, and we think, I've been praised, I'm a success. And again, equanimity is disturbed. If this or that work that we've done doesn't succeed or isn't praised in the way we want it to be, one might think that my work has failed, or maybe we think I've failed, and again, equanimity is shaken. If our wealth, our money, or a loved one is lost, one thinks what's mine is gone, and equanimity is shaken. unwavering mountain of equanimity is always shaken in the delusion of the identification of me, of mine, of I am. As our heart opens and understanding deepens, there's an easing of the constrictive feeling and the constrictive thoughts based in self-centeredness. Unshakable equanimity, unshakable equanimity of the mind, of the heart, is established by giving up, by relinquishing all possessive thoughts, the thoughts of mine, which in itself might be quite a daunting thought. And so we begin with the small things from which it's easy to detach oneself, and then gradually working up to the possessions, maybe goals and identifications that we so tightly, so tenaciously cling on to. Last time, I think about 6 years ago now, that I taught at the Forest Refuge in Barre, Massachusetts, was for 2 months. And I was the very first visiting teacher there. And I was there long enough for 2 months to really settle in and into the place that I was staying in. And yet again and again and again, there was the awareness that the house that I was staying in wasn't mine. And it came about in a number of small ways and sometimes in quite surprising ways. When I first got there, there was no telephone in the house. It was a brand new house. No one had ever lived in it before. But there was no phone. And so it was difficult to not have a phone. For instance, when I needed to check email or send email, I had to carry my computer over to another building and use a phone that was set aside for emergencies for the yogis that were practicing at the Forest Refuge. So I lobbied, as we call it in English, I lobbied for a phone. Which, in moments, especially at the beginning, felt like this phone was for me. And there was quite a degree of stress, quite a degree of tension in this. But in truth, the phone was for many, many others who would be using that house over many, many years. At one point, I was told that it was okay. It's a big institution, so I had to go through a lot of various channels to be okayed. But eventually I was told that it was okay, that a phone was going to be put in the house. But when that was going to happen, nobody knew yet. So at that point, there was a very quick letting go, and I didn't think about it anymore. I relaxed, and I truly began to feel that it really didn't matter if the phone arrived while I was there or not, because I recognized that it wasn't for me. It really wasn't for me. It wasn't mine. It did arrive, by the way, before I left. It's still there. And it was decided to purchase a small carpet for the house, for the living room of the house. And being the first visiting teacher, Jeannie, the housekeeper at the Forest Refuge, brought over the rug catalog for us to go shopping together. Another shopping story. That time it was clearly not a rug for me. It wasn't for my house. We were choosing for everyone, or choosing for anyone. And I noticed there was quite a big difference in the experience in the heart. there wasn't that subtle contraction of something being for me. It was much more fun, actually. There was an openness, a spaciousness. As I said, not that contraction, no clinging in the choosing. So, the small things at first. And working up to giving up, to letting go, to relinquishing such thoughts of self. Beginning with objects of seeming minor importance that we think are ours. And then beginning to relinquish the identification maybe with some of the qualities that we are identified with as who we think we are. Our personality, we could call it. It's important to recognize or know that it's the thought of these being who I am that we relinquish. And that's a very important point. It's the clinging thought of these being who I am that we give up, that we let go of. So, beginning with the small aspects of our personality, maybe qualities of quite minor, seemingly minor importance. And then very slowly through our practice, working up to letting go of identification, basically practicing detachment in relationship to maybe those emotions and aversions that we may regard as the very center of our being. Ajahn Sumedho, who some of you may be familiar with or know of, he's the abbot of the Amaravati Monastery in England, and he's the senior disciple still alive of Ajahn Chah, who was a great Thai meditation master. And Ajahn Sumedho shares a quite a wonderful story about practicing with this. He says that when a particular tendency of his shows up, and in this case he's talking about the critical mind, the judgmental mind, he says to himself, "Oh, there's my personality." Can our personality be impersonal? Can we relinquish our identity with this or that being who I am, being me, even including the emotional states and maybe various aversions which we might regard, as I said, and be identified with as the very center of our being? As we let go of, as we relinquish thoughts of mine, thoughts of me, thoughts of self, to the degree we let go, that's the degree that equanimity will enter our heart. How could anything that we realize, really truly realize as not me, not mine, not who I am, cause us any agitation due to greed or lust or hatred or fear or grief? A particular Buddhist teaching that we went into to some degree the other evening. This is the teaching that the Buddha offered his son Rahula when Rahula was 18 years old about the four great elements: the earth, wind, air, and fire. I'd like to share that teaching more directly as it was written in the sutta, as it was given to Rahula. But first I'd like to give you a little bit of background on why this teaching was given. Because in the In the Buddhist teachings, they're always given in relationship to real people. They're not, and for a reason. And it's interesting and helpful to know this. So the story behind this particular sutta, behind this particular teaching, was that the Buddha and his 18-year-old son, who was a monk at that time, were going into town, and Rahula was following his father, the Buddha, on this particular day as they were on their way into the village for alms rounds. He was walking behind his father, the Buddha, and with much admiration he noted the physical perfection of his father, the Buddha. And he reflected with pride that he himself was of similar appearance. And so the thinking in the background material says that Rahula, and who knows if he really said this, but it makes sense, he thinking to himself, he said, "I too am handsome like my father, the Blessed One," as he was called. And the Buddha's form is beautiful, and so is mine. Well, must not have been very easy to have such a father, because the Buddha could read his mind. No privacy for Rahula. So, in fact, the Buddha read Rahula's thoughts and decided to admonish him right then and there, so that such vain thoughts wouldn't lead him to greater difficulties. So the Buddha at that point framed his advice to his son and told him to contemplate the body as neither a self nor as a possession of a self. And so Rahula felt rightly scolded by his father, and he decided not to keep going into the village for alms rounds with his father, and he sat down under the tree that was by the side of the road to reflect on his father's admonishment and to the teaching that was given to him. And his father continued on into the village. But soon Rahula got very distracted because Venerable Sariputta came along and they got into a conversation, and that was the end of his reflection. That evening, when both the Buddha and Rahula were back at the place that they were staying, the Buddha gave his son another teaching because the first one didn't work. So he gave him a teaching to show him the quality of impartiality, basically the quality of equanimity, in order to dispel his attachment to the body, which hadn't been removed by the teaching earlier that day. And the Buddha uses the four great elements in this teaching on equanimity as a metaphor and as a direct teaching in relationship to the body itself, simply being a composite of the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. And in this teaching, he also adds the space element, which didn't come up in the lion's roar talk the other evening. And what the Buddha means in terms of the space element is all of the openings, all of the apertures in the body internally, and then all of the space around everywhere. So this is a part of the teaching, part of the it's a fairly long sutta, so I'm only going to offer you part of it, and some of it is a repeat from what we heard the other night, but as I've mentioned, I think these teachings were repeated again and again and again and again, and within a teaching there were many repetitions, and I've read this sutta many times and still learn from it. So this is the Buddha talking to his son. And by the way, just to mention that there are a number of suttas in the collection of the teachings from the Buddha that are teachings that he, as far as we know, directly gave Rahula from when Rahula was a little boy. Rahula joined the Sangha when he was 6 years old, and until he grew up and became enlightened. And I find those teachings really quite special, because there's a certain kind of intimacy in those teachings. It's subtle, very subtle, because the Buddha was, Rahula was when he was his son. But there is a certain subtle intimacy in those teachings that is really quite special, and I've looked over the years for those particular teachings because of that particular kind of sweet quality that shows up in these teachings. You will develop a meditation that is like earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, such as excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood on the earth, and the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that is like water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people wash clean and dirty things, such as excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood in water, and water is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like water. For when you develop meditation that is like water, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that is like fire. And he goes through the same process. And Rahula, develop meditation that is like air. Just as air blows on clean things and dirty things, such as excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood, and the air is not horrified, humiliated, and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like air. For when you develop meditation that is like air, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as space is not established anywhere, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen, agreeable, and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. This is our practice. To whatever degree we abandon, to whatever degree we relinquish thoughts of mine, of me, of I am, to whatever degree we forsake thoughts of self, equanimity will enter our heart. When we really truly realize anything as void of a self, in those moments, as I've already said, how could it cause us any agitation due to lust or hatred or fear or grief or greed? So the teaching and the practice of anatta is our guide along the path to liberation, our guide along the path to perfect equanimity. Equanimity, this perfectly unshakable balance of mind, unshakable balance of heart, is rooted in insight. And the first insight being that of kamma, and the second being anatta, that we've just very briefly explored this evening. the heart, the mind of specific neutrality. It isn't cold. It's not heartless. It's not dull. It doesn't manifest out of an emotional emptiness, but really out of a fullness or a completeness of connection, a fullness and completeness of understanding. And at some point in our practice, if we keep practicing, equanimity will evolve from being relative equanimity to an absolute equanimity, and will develop into an equanimity that is really the manifestation of the highest strength and insight. In the progress of insight, when equanimity is strong, when it's fulfilled, concentration or samadhi and understanding occur coupled together without either one exceeding the other. And those two qualities, concentration and samadhi, along with an imbalance with mindfulness, with investigation, with a balanced effort, with a calm and joyful heart. And those are all the factors of enlightenment. With all of these occurring at that point with one single taste, the single taste of awakening, deliverance, as it's sometimes called, deliverance from the kilesas, or deliverance from the afflictive emotions or the cankers, deliverance from suffering. The fruit of equanimity, or the deliverance of equanimity in the mind, in the heart, is what we could call the escape from craving, the escape from greed. We've escaped it finally. And the word in Pali is tanha. And there's an interesting, there are many translations of tanha, but I think one of the most graphic and experientially graphic is the word thirst. That insatiable thirst that we have, that is the fruit or the deliverance of equanimity, this escape from this insatiable thirst. Point, there's, and before that point, to varying degrees, there's insight knowledge, insight understanding into the dangers of the afflictive emotions, into the dangers of what are, another word is called the defilements, and insight knowledge into the advantages of purification. At this point, insight or understanding produces what the Buddha called a satisfiedness, or a purifiedness, or a clarifiedness. All those three words are used within one's heart, within one's mind. With all of this happening or manifesting due to onlooking equanimity, which at this point is called absolute equanimity, or it's sometimes called holy equanimity. And in the words of the Buddha, just as all of the streams of the world enter the great ocean, and all of the waters of the sky rain into it, but not increase or decrease of the great ocean is seen, such is the nature of holy equanimity. Well, I found a particular description of a liberated mind, a liberated heart, what was often called by the Buddha the mind of six-limbed equanimity. And I found it to be a really amazingly beautiful metaphor for this, so I'd like to share it with you. The mind, the heart of six-limbed equanimity. The mind and heart of an awakened one is likened to a clear, well-cut crystal. And because it's clear, without stains, it fully absorbs all the rays of light and sends them out again, intensified by the power and purity of its concentrated energy. The crystal can't be tainted by the colors of the rays. Its hardness can't be pierced. Its perfectly harmonious structure can't be disturbed. In its purity and strength, the crystal remains unchanged. The equanimity of an awakened one is unshakable because it's absolute, and it's absolute simply because it clings to nothing. And this is our possibility. Aid, as nutriment, as it's called in the texts, for the arising and the development of equanimity, the Buddha offers us some very practical, very specific directions. He tells us to approach and to listen to recollect and to go forth after monks, nuns, and laypersons who are accomplished in virtue, accomplished in sila, who are accomplished in concentration, insight, and who have the knowledge and vision of liberation. He tells us that hearing the Dhamma talks of such people is helpful, or from such people is helpful. He tells us to dwell mindfully and to investigate states, states of mind, states of body, and that if we investigate with care and wisdom, our energy will be aroused in a good way, without weakening, without slacking. And when this happens, a spiritual joy is aroused and develops. And then he goes on to say that when one's mind and heart is uplifted with spiritual joy, that the body will become tranquil, calm. And when the body is tranquil, one's mind becomes tranquil. And when one's body is tranquil, and who's quiet and happy in the heart and the mind is very easily concentrated. And when concentration develops and deepens, one is able to look on with equanimity at the mind that's concentrated. And we're also told that there are particular conditions in our life that will help towards the arising and the development of equanimity. Maintaining a neutrality toward living beings. Maintaining a neutrality towards inanimate objects. Not spending a lot of time with possessive people. Associating with people who maintain neutrality toward beings and towards inanimate objects. And lastly, the Buddha tells us to make a resolve to incline the mind, to incline the heart towards the arising, the development, and the fulfillment of equanimity. I'll spend a little bit of time now looking at equanimity as one of the Brahmaviharas, as one of the divine abidings with you, and its relationship or interrelationship with the other three divine abidings. This quality or capacity, this radiant calm, spaciousness, stillness, balance of heart, balance of mind, stabilizes the positive effects of metta, compassion, mudita, mindfulness, and understanding, wisdom. Specifically with metta, or love, equanimity gives love or gives metta an evenness, gives it an unchanging firmness and loyalty. And it endows love with the great virtue of patience. In relationship to compassion, equanimity furnishes compassion with an unwavering courage, with a fearlessness, which enables us to directly face what might be a huge hole or chasm of unhappiness, of despair, of anguish in relationship to the pain, physical or mental pain, and other kinds of suffering in the world, coming to us from around in the world from other people, and also in relationship to our own personal experience. So to be able to face this, regarding the active side of compassion, equanimity is the calm mind, the calm heart, and the steady hand that endows compassion with understanding, wisdom. We could say that equanimity is patience, the patient devotion to the work of compassion. And also equanimity keeps the heart, the mind, from moving into a kind of selfish isolation or from indulging in various distractions so as to stay away from or stay disconnected from suffering, from the pain in life. Both, of course, selfish isolation and distraction are rooted in fear. Until equanimity is really fully present in us, it's as though compassion keeps urging us to enter again and again and again, to enter into the struggles of life, both personally and into the struggles in the world, what one person called the battlefield of the world, in order to strengthen itself, in order to strengthen equanimity. And it's as though compassion keeps pushing us again and again to enter in. It's as though we're learning to withstand the test, so to say. Very immediate practical learning. And the last one I'd like to mention in relationship to equanimity is equanimity and mudita, which I already did mention this a little bit. This even-mindedness, the balance of mind that's rooted in understanding, is really what protects the mind from getting lost in a kind of blind, giddy, self-centered joy, which I mentioned in the talk on mudita. So it's equanimity, really, that protects us from that. A methodical meditative practice will help love, compassion, joy, equanimity to become spontaneous in our lives. Make the mind calmer, firmer, in its capacity to withstand all the numerous difficulties, the irritations that come up in life, and that challenge us again and again and again. We're challenged again and again to maintain these qualities, the quality of metta, the quality of compassion, quality of joy and equanimity. And so a methodical meditative practice, as I'm sure you recognize, at least to some degree, helps us. Our daily life, our practical daily conduct in life, is more and more governed by these qualities, these divine abidings. Our mind, our heart, will hold considerably less resentment, less tension, less irritability, less fear, less anger, with the reverberations of all of this, subtly or not so subtly, they always make their way into our meditation practice, as I'm sure you're well aware of. They bring us a lot of restlessness, restlessness is probably the primary overall hindrance that comes about when these mind states of irritability, irritation, fear, anger, as they show up in the body. Yes, our everyday life influences our meditation practice. Our meditation practice influences our everyday life. And as we practice more, the gap between them decreases. Persistent practice consistently decreases, narrows the gap between our practice and our daily life. Another thing I might mention is that meditative development of these divine abidings is also aided by repeated reflection. We did some reflections with them, reflecting in your daily life, in your practice, about their qualities, the particular qualities, and how you think about them, which will change as you practice and your reflections will show up some different things. That's helpful. Also reflecting on the benefits that these capacities of the heart, capacities of the mind offer. And also reflecting on the dangers of their opposites. So practicing, actually practicing, and also spending some time reflecting. It's very helpful. The Buddha said that what a person considers and reflects on for a long time, to that his or her mind will bend, to that his or her mind will incline. So we practice here in retreat, we practice at home in the midst of our daily lives, and we practice with sincerity, we practice with diligence. We sit with a growing understanding. We sit with the blossoming of insight. As awakening beings, we practice with aspiration. We have aspirations in our practice. And, of course, with determination. For us that each of the wholesome factors of mind, of heart, and all of the liberating insights will eventually sprout, eventually blossom, and eventually mature within us if we keep practicing. It's our karma, we could say. We have a good karma to be doing this. I'd like to close this evening's talk with two short pieces from a particular collection of the teachings that come from the Buddha. It's called the Udana, which are the inspired utterances of the Buddha. They're very short little teachings, and with each teaching comes a little story, which we're not going to look at the stories, just the teachings. But it's a lovely book, and you might look for it. It's a small book, and very inspiring book. Whose mind stands like a mountain, steady, is not perturbed, unattached to things that arouse attachment, unangered by things that provoke anger. When her or his mind is cultivated thus, how can suffering come to her or him? The second piece from the Udana. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who clings not, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there's no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. Where no coming nor going is, there is neither arising nor passing away. Where neither arising nor passing away is, there is neither this world nor the world beyond, nor any place between the two. This, in truth, is the end of suffering. That one's a little bit hard to understand for some people. The world that's being that's meant here is the world of me, the world of I, the world of clinging, the world of identification. And when there's no clinging, there's no movement of the mind. There's neither this world of me, nor that world of me, nor me in between the two. And that's the end of suffering. And that's a very simple explanation, but in case you were confused, just a few moments.